and Pasvar. The dean of the college at that time was a relatively weak traditional figure, an associate professor of history, and Peek resolved to replace him. He replaced him with Jerome Schneewind, S-C-H-N-E-E-W-I-N-D, what I would refer to as a WASH, a white Anglo-Saxon Hebrew. Schneewind has gone on, is a philosopher. He and I jointly taught a course which came to me as the contents of which came to me as a great surprise. We shared an interest in 18th century and 17th century English political philosophy, and this was the formative period of the economic discipline and the formative period of utilitarianism, which was Schneewind's great interest. We seemed to strike it off very well, and I suggested that perhaps we should teach a course jointly where the philosophy students could learn a little bit about the English applications of philosophy to questions of moral philosophy to questions of economic organization. And economic students would learn much more about utilitarianism than I was able to give them. The course turned out to be a disaster from my standpoint, simply because I had not realized that Schneewind was so much opposed to theology that he refused to have any discussion of theological questions in the course. Now, in my view about universities, I take very much the view of Cardinal Newman, the university should be concerned with all kinds of knowledge, not just what Schneewind would have called real knowledge or scientific knowledge or knowledge apart from the superstitions of religion. In any event, we ended the course with something of less than mutual admiration. And shortly thereafter, Schneewind was appointed as dean of the college, replacing James Garner, the aforementioned historian. Schneewind was very socially very close to my colleagues Bramholt and Houston. And at the height of the agitation, when I first reduced their annual increment and the next erased an annual increment, Schneewind, from his own budget, gave the increment to these men. The two came by to see me and chortled that I had been
circumvented
is a good word. And I retorted that they didn't understand economics as well as I did, that he gave them a bonus, but I gave them an increment in their base, that the $1,000 that they didn't get from me would be $1,000 compounded for as long as they remained at the university. The $1,000 they got from him was just a one-time or a two-time shot, as it turned out. At that point, the dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, a physicist, decided that he had had enough, and he resigned. And Peek and Pasvar appointed Jerome Rosenberg to become dean. Jerome and I had been socially friendly. He had been very courteous to us when we came, had entertained us. He had sponsored my entry into the Young People's Synagogue, and so forth. When he was offered the deanship, he told me that I was one of three people whose opinions he wanted. I had cautioned him against taking the deanship, saying that I did not think that he was tough enough to handle the situation well. Well, I was wrong. He took the deanship, and within a few weeks, he forced me to resign. He did this by simply announcing at a faculty meeting, meeting of department chairman, that the department budgets in the future would be subject to the veto of the dean of the college, and that there was no appeal beyond it, or there would be no appeal beyond it. I had said to him previously that my control over my budget was the only way that I could handle the economics department, particularly since there was so much anti-Pazdar leadership in the department, in the persons of Bramwell and Houston. Well, when the meeting was over, I went up to him and I said to him, "Well, you know, I've just resigned." And he said, "I was afraid that would happen. Can we have lunch?" And we had lunch. And I went over the ground very clearly and said, "I had said the following. You have done the following. And that adds up to my resigning. I consider myself to have resigned." Later in the week, Charlie Peake came to see me. And even Pazdar came to see me to find out why I felt so strongly. Well, the truth is that I felt strongly, but I also had been asked to create a very large journal for the American Economic Association, and I was extraordinarily busy. The further truth is that when it comes to drawing lines in the sand, I draw them only once. It's not a wise way to live, but it's the way I've lived. If I say to you, this is how my reasoning goes, and if you cross this line, I'm out of it. I tend to move that way. There have been times when people have explained to me that my line was inaccurately drawn or inadequately drawn, and that I didn't take everything into account, and I have relented, or more accurately, apologized. But in this particular case, nothing Jerome said, or anything that Peake said, or Pazdar said, made me believe that I could handle an economics department under these circumstances.
How were other departments behaving?
Well, no other department chairman had used his budget power so strongly. Mm-hmm. Now, my view on the budget power for the chairman should be mentioned here. I became chairman just after Litchfield fell. The university was saddled with a monumental debt. Much of the debt was the result of Litchfield's borrowing, but a very large portion of the debt was a disallowing of expenditures from grants made by the federal government. The federal government, when it makes research grants to universities, requires that the university specify how much of the professor's paid for time is going to be spent on those projects. This means, in point of fact, that if the professor does not reduce his teaching load, the federal government will disallow the part of the contract. I was very much opposed to grants, because in the case of the economics department, my own time had been sold several times over. This was a standard university practice, and the government accounting office caught the university on it. When I became chairman, I said to Peake, if you will give me budgetary power, I will make a deal with you. We will create a figure of called shadow revenue. We know how much the university charges per credit, undergraduates and graduates per credit. And we know how many credit hours the department is, of tuition the department is providing. We will, if you will use this as an accounting basis, and you will assure me that the department will get 4/7 of the value of its credit hours, I will increase the department teaching load, which I did. However, as my part of the bargain, there were several elements. First, this department will have more research funds than had been previously promised. This is after the debacle with the government accounting office. Secondly, it will have more support funds, travel funds, seminar funds, secretarial funds, equipment funds, than had been previously promised. Beyond that, I will have to have budget power. That is to say, I can say to people in my department, there is a formula for increments. And if you meet the formula, you will get an increment. If there is any money, there was in those days. If you do not meet the formula, you won't, and it's that, just that simple. And I had others, I think it was Sam Hayes, called my Mickey Mouse system, where I said teaching counts has a weighting of 5, research has a weighting of 5, departmental service has a weighting of 3, public activities has a weighting of 3, and university service, as distinct from department service, has a weighting of 3. Full professors would be expected to have a higher point count at the end of the year, then assistant or associate professors. And my system also involved saying to people, this is how I calculated your point score, tell me where I made mistakes. And often they did. In many cases, they pointed out to me that I had, hadn't given them sufficient credit. But it seemed to me it was to try to make rather objective what is essentially a subjective process. So this is what I had demanded from Peek, and Peek had agreed. Now, in this period, I was also aware that I was becoming increasingly unpopular because of my hardline views, my bottom line views, I suppose. And it occurred to me that it would be a very good thing if I was given a chair. And so I suggested this to Peek. Explained to him that I wanted the chair for reasons of self-protection, that if I were to remain chairman during this period of the university bitterness, and particularly since so much of the bitterness was focused in my own department, it would be very useful if I were made a chair professor and therefore responsible directly to the provost or the chancellor, rather than through the usual line of authority, namely the department chairman or the dean. Charlie understood the problems that I saw, was sympathetic with it, and the only question was, under what terms can I be made a chair professor? There, at that time, Edgar M. Hoover was the university professor of economics, which was one of the only chair we had. Hoover took the view that he didn't care whether he was a university professor or anything else, but he understood my particular problem. But Charlie thought that rather than making me a distinguished service professor, a title which incidentally I invented, there are many distinguished service professors at the university now, but I invented the title, having taken it from the title that Frank Knight had at the University of Chicago. But Charlie said that I hadn't done enough service for the university to become a distinguished service professor, a point of view which I didn't disagree. And he agreed that Hoover should become distinguished service professor and I would become the university professor. And that's how I got the chair. Well, having the chair, I then took the view that, well, I could move out of the chairmanship without much visible retaliation from any successor. And that's pretty much what happened. Throughout this period, I remained friendly with Pozsgar. He was very bitter later on at my not having a disciplined Bramhall, and particularly Houston, who had physically hit him, he claims. And I remember Pozsgar calling me in on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, and he was so agitated, even though I never go to the university in Rosh Hashanah, I went down to see him, and he was terribly angry about what he thought was the Houston business. And my telling him, look, if you will recall, and I have it on paper, I had sent you a memorandum showing you under what bases you could discipline Houston, but I personally recommended against it because I thought it would lead to more bitterness. And at that time, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Solon Horowitz, had been brought to Pitt by Pozsgar, and Solon was a lawyer, and I spent a good deal of time composing the memorandum that I sent to Pozsgar, outlining exactly what the facts on the Houston business were. And of course, that kind of relationship that kind of relationship with PASVAR shows not only how seriously I was taken in this business, but the animus towards the development of the business. I think PASVAR felt I should have handled Houston differently from the way I did, and I took the view that my job was simply to report to him what could be done, and if he didn't choose to pursue it, and I hoped he wouldn't, the thing would be best handled that way.
Mm-hmm.
In later years, I worked for PASVAR on several projects. I think that there is a great deal of respect for me, but I think there is also a great deal of feeling that I am not a good team player. When PASVAR left the university, there was great bitterness towards him. The faculty seemed to me to outdo themselves in their expression of dislike of him. And when I discovered that the people were not speaking to him on elevators, and that many of his once friends were literally turning their backs to him, I decided that this was uncivilized, and I initiated a program of incorporating him in faculty groups, for which he has become particularly grateful. I must say that his wife has expressed this on many, many occasions. He is a very brilliant individual. He is a military man. He tends to view things as often civilized military men do. He does not articulate his rage or articulate his strong feelings, but he feels them. He has a memory like an elephant, and very few slights go unrecorded. On the other hand, he's a wise man, and he knows when to suppress memories which are would make him functionally awkward.
Mm-hmm. You know, people look back at the interim chancellor, Kurtzman, and he was known as the inter. He never was appointed. How is that, and why wasn't he fully appointed?
Well, Kurtzman was a very remarkable human being, a very warm man, one who it was very hard not to not only like, but literally to love. However, he was well beyond his depth as chancellor, mm-hmm. as interim chancellor. Mm-hmm. I might add that after he retired, PASVAR asked the trustees to designate him as chancellor emeritus.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a chancellor of the university, but appointed only after he had been interim mm-hmm. chancellor and had already retired.
Mm-hmm.
When the university ran into problems after his retirement as acting chancellor or interim chancellor, he became at one point dean of the Graduate School of Public International Affairs. Mm-hmm. I remember his remarking that he never realized how hard it was to be a dean. My telling him at the time, you don't realize how much harder it is to be a professor. You've never been one, which is true. However, let me say a little bit about David. His virtue was his thorough honesty. No one ever accused him of being subtle, in the sense of conniving or sly or shrewd. One of the major blunders he made as acting chancellor was a decision to revise the control of the university senate. The university senate had been chaired by the chancellor of the university. That had been the pattern from the time of its creation. Their turnout at university senate meetings was always very large, because it was at those meetings that Litchfield would announce his programs and would take questions. Now, this meant that Litchfield could be questioned pretty closely as to why he was allocating resources the way that he did. I do not believe that the faculty ever changed his allocation, but his decision to allocate resources was made with the full understanding that he would have to explain it to people whose economic interests were being hurt by the way he decided things. I don't remember just where we interrupted here, but David Kurtzman decided to make the president of the Senate a faculty elective office. Since that time, the Senate has dwindled to nothing, and the various presidents of the Senate are agreeable political figures in the university, but almost never distinguished for their scholarship or distinguished for their other forms of what I would consider positive university leadership. Another characteristic of Kurtzman was, I would think, his lack of appreciation of the problems of undergraduates. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing him twice in one day. There was a university luncheon at GISPIA, GSPIA, the Graduate School of Public and Rational Affairs, where Vasily Leontief, Leontief, was the speaker. Vasily and I are old friends. I was at that point
Nobel.
He later got a Nobel Award.
In economics.
Yes, in economics. Vasily was the inventor of input-output analysis. Mm-hmm. And we were old friends. He had been president of the American Economic Association while I was the founding editor of the Journal of Economic Literature. And I was invited to the luncheon, I presume, on that basis. And David and I sat at the same table. And I don't remember what I was holding forth on, but David clearly disagreed. But he commented to me that he always found talking to me very stimulating because I always gave him ideas that he hadn't thought about. Well, it turned out that evening we were also invited to a dinner. So he had the benefit of my counter ideas twice in the same day. By the end of the dinner, he was no longer so appreciative of my ideas. But the discussion is an interesting one. As I recall, David was suggesting that we should expand the enrollment of the University of Pittsburgh by about 30%, particularly the undergraduate enrollment, because this was both a good revenue measure for the university and, he believed, good for the young people of Western Pennsylvania, the source of most of our undergraduate students. And I was saying to him that I disagreed, that I thought that we could, that Oakland was not large enough to absorb that many undergraduates, that the housing problem would become very tight. But more than that, I was very much concerned about the propinquity of the university students and the Hill, the black communities on the Hill. I said that there was a deviation in purpose and an interest between these two groups of young people, and I thought there would be a great deal of conflict. I still think I was right, but I don't believe that at that time David thought that this was a problem that couldn't be handled. We also argued very much over school busing policy. David was the architect of the school busing program for Pennsylvania. And I said that whereas I was a great believer in civil liberties, I also was a great believer in the problems of education, and that it was very hard to educate youngsters where all the energy had to go into maintaining peace and calm in the classroom. All this time was to point out, I think, is to prove our two views are very major differing views of mm-hmm. the problems of the country.
Mm-hmm.
When Pozsvar came, Pozsvar did a great deal to honor Kurtzman. I mentioned, jump for a minute, after I mentioned earlier that after Pozsvar was dismissed or told to resign, he was shunned by the university. And I remember taking him for lunch at the, what was then, whatever the restaurant was in Webster Hall. With two different
at Webster Hall.
Webster Hall.
No, it was its last reincarnation, whatever the name of it was. And saying, "Do you know, Wes, Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh has always trashed its chancellors. When Bowman was fired, the man who had really created the modern University of Pittsburgh, he was trashed. When his successor was fired, he wasn't trashed, but he was ignored. You are the great exception. You did not trash Kurtzman." Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't say, but it was true. You were critical of Litchfield, and more critical of Litchfield than I thought you should have been. But the fact is, you didn't trash Kurtzman.
Yeah.
And one of the great problems of an institution is what to do with the former leader. And in case of Kurtzman, he was just universally so admired. One gained points, really, by honoring him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my major objection to Kurtzman's leadership was that he did not combine with this mix, the spectacular kindness and probity, the necessary shrewdness for university development. And in that sense, it was very desirable that he be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
We became socially quite friendly with the Kurtzmans, and at one point I heard that he had had a heart attack, and the initial report was that he would recover, and so I remember writing him a letter. I was a fellow of a college in Cambridge, in England at the time, saying, "Well, now you've had your heart attack, now you should take your rest, I should do your exercise, and then you should come back and be active again." Well, the next thing I heard is he was dead.
Yeah.
So my letter, as I recall it, was particularly inappropriate. But it was appropriate in the sense that it reflected great warmth and enthusiasm and indeed love for him.
Mm-hmm.
His wife was a marvelous woman.
What was her first name?
Cecile.
Cecile, right.
Cecile was a marvelous woman. Very much of a motherly figure.
Mm.
She had none of the social engineering qualities that Mary Litchfield had.
Mm-hmm.
Litchfield could be imperious, and Mary would sort of smooth off the rough edges. She was marvelous at that. And Cecile had none of the career charisma which Mildred Pozsvar has. Mildred is a prima donna in the best sense of the word, a distinguished artist, a creative person, and a person of indefatigable imagination and energy. Cecile was just a nice a woman who did the right things, who had the right sentiments, and who reflected exactly the kind of person her husband was, which was nice, warm, friendly, and intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the picture I have of Kurtzman.
Mm-hmm.
It is very interesting that on the subject that after Pozsvar was retired, and retired at full pay for the rest of his life, the next president of the university, Dennis O'Connor, demanded that Pozsvar teach. And Pozsvar called me up and said, "They're making me teach. You know how I can get some good graduate students?" And I said, "You don't want graduate students. You want honor students from your honors college. They're the brightest students we have at the university." And he said, "What's wrong with graduate students?" And I said, "Well, the graduate students we have here are not as bright as the honor students. Occasionally you run into a brilliant graduate student, but I wouldn't count on him." I said there was an old story about a man who became a professor at Oxford, who said that the difference between his honors students, his undergraduates and his graduates, were that when he came in the morning in a lecture and said, "Good morning, gentlemen," if the students wrote it down, they were the graduate students. In any case, I think that Kurtzman, who did teach those students at Gisbea, enjoyed the teaching thoroughly. I think he had remarked to me that if he had only been teaching before he had become either a dean or a chancellor, he would have seen the university life mm-hmm. from a far more difficult mm-hmm. perspective. One of the provosts, a black by the name of Don Henderson, when he became assistant provost, said that I told him, "Now remember, Don, that what is important at the university is what happens in the classroom."